Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, who needs faith when we've got science? You've heard that one, no doubt. Ken will explore this issue as we continue to look at his latest book, Christianity Cross-Examined, Is It Rational, Relevant, and Good? And Ken, you address this topic and more in your book, and we're covering it on a series of podcasts that we sure hope people listening will pick up your book and join us.
Yeah, you know, I'm really, really excited. The new book, Christianity Cross-Examined, has been hovering around the number one spot on new releases in the area of religious studies science and faith issues. So on Amazon, there is the Kindle edition, which is an ebook. And while I'm a exclusively print person, there are a lot of people out there who enjoy ebooks, and I'm very pleased, Joe, that they're downloading, purchasing the ebook, and at Reasons to Believe, we're selling the print book. Mm-hmm. So if you go on the website and take a look at our store, you can get a copy of the print book. You can even maybe get a copy of a Ken Samples autograph if you are really a good kid. But we're going to take a look at this ongoing question of science and faith. And I'm going to touch on, in our next couple programs, I'm going to touch on some of the points that I make in my first two chapters in my book, Christianity Cross-Examined. And I'll be appealing to some previous chapters of other books, because this is kind of an ongoing discussion about Christianity's unique relationship to science.
All right, sounds good. And this certainly is a relevant topic in many different arenas of the culture. You find this idea, this alleged tension between science and faith coming up quite a bit. So we're glad to be able to discuss it and looking for your insights on this, Ken.
Yeah, very good. In my new book, I have the first two chapters are entitled, the first chapter is entitled, Hasn't Scientific Discovery Made God Unnecessary? And Joe, as you just mentioned, that's a very common sentiment. The second chapter is also placed as an interrogative, a question, who needs faith when we've got science? And so that kind of moves us into our discussion of science and faith. And I want to tackle a number of things. I have kind of a 5-point outline that I'd like to cover in the next number of shows, and we'll make some headway in this program and in the next program. But I think about this topic kind of in 5 parts in terms of the presentation. And again, if you want to look at my first two chapters in Christianity Cross-Examined, you can also look back to a chapter I have in Without a Doubt. And then I have 2 chapters in 7 Truths That Changed the World. So Christianity's relationship to science, Joe and Dave, I think is a very important topic. In fact, I'm willing to go out on the limb here and say that I think possibly the 2 biggest challenges to Christianity would be, one, its relationship to science. That's, you know, the intellectual Western world, people want to know. I can't accept a worldview that is not compatible with science. Maybe the other biggest challenge would be the question of the world's religions. How can Christianity be exclusively true in our mindset of kind of postmodernism, where we're very open to religious pluralism and truth claims are relative? And I guess you could probably raise the 3rd question would be this whole bigger question of kind of a postmodern mindset. But we've addressed some of those things before, and we'll come back to them again. But I'd like to begin this program by looking at 5 points. The first one, Christianity's influence upon science. Second, Christianity and modern science. Third, Christianity's challenge. Third, the scientific challenge to Christianity. Four would be Christianity and naturalism. And five, two views of science that Christians should avoid. Now, again, those five broad points we'll address over a number of shows. And on this program, I want to look exclusively at that first question: what is Christianity's influence upon science? And I think a great place to begin that discussion is to go back to a presentation that Paul Davies gave when he received the Templeton Prize. I'm sure virtually everybody listening to me right now knows that the Templeton Prize is awarded to various people who make contributions in the field of religion and theology. And it doesn't have to be somebody who is kind of classically religious. Paul Davies, for example, I think he would probably describe himself as an agnostic, but he received the prize a number of years ago. And Davies is just a very intriguing individual for me. He is a well-known physicist and cosmologist. He's written multiple books. I find him very engaging. Not too long ago, RTB had some interaction with Paul Davies on one of the other programs that RTB does. And I've read Paul Davies a lot, and I like him very much. I think one of the reasons I like him so much is he's not only a brilliant scholar, I think that he's very fair-minded. And I want to read a paragraph or two that he has in his Templeton Prize address. He says this. He says, in the ensuing 300 years, the theological dimension of science has faded. People take it for granted that the physical world is both ordered and intelligible. The underlying order in nature, the laws of physics, are simply accepted as given, as brute facts. Nobody asks where they came from. At least they don't do so in polite company. Then he says this, however, even the most atheistic scientist accepts as an act of faith that the universe is not absurd, that there is a rational basis to physical existence manifested as law-like order in nature that is at least part comprehensible to us. And then here is the concluding statement that I find very powerful. He says, so science can proceed only if the scientist adopts an essentially theological worldview. Now that is an extraordinary statement. And by the way, I should inform you that some of the outspoken secular scientists have not been very appreciative of Davies kind of his recognition that science is a position that religious people could embrace. And so he's been criticized by Lawrence Krauss and other outspoken atheists by saying that, you know, he's kind of coddling people who are religious. But I think that quotation is a very powerful one, because what it's essentially telling us is that science is not independent of beliefs, that to do science, you have to adopt an essentially a worldview. And that is that there's a real world out there, that it's ordered, that it reflects regularity. And therefore, Davies says, look, maybe a lot of people have forgotten that science emerged within a theological context, and the worldview that produced science was Christian theism. And so when people tell me, for example, that science is incompatible with, or Christianity is incompatible with science, or that the two don't mix, I think that fails to appreciate two critical ideas that we'll talk about in this program. One is the historical connection. Again, it was 300 years ago or 400 years ago that we find you know, science emerging in a religious worldview context. But the other thing that I think that that forgets is that the presuppositions of science, that is the starting points of science, are very compatible with not only religion, but with Christian theism. So
can I make a comment here or ask you to comment?
Yeah,
what you frequently experience when you talk to scientists who are unbelievers, they don't make a distinction between an explanation for why the universe is comprehensible or is real, or, you know, all these things that you express as presuppositions. They don't make a distinction between that and the fact that they observe that it's so. So they seem to be quite happy with, hey, we see it, that's the way it is, rather than why is it the way that it is?
Yeah.
Can you expand on that, or do you have any?
Yeah. Yeah, Dave, and in fact, that's one of the points that I make in chapter two of my new book, Christianity Cross-Examined. I say that a lot of times scientists are not aware of the importance of worldview thinking or philosophy in general, because oftentimes the questions that we're addressing, they're not directly science questions. They're more philosophy of science questions. And I think what science is really good at is kind of the what questions or the how questions, but the why questions are missing in science. And a lot of times, not only is the average kind of layperson, but Dave, a lot of times scientists themselves are not aware that science is deeply rooted in philosophical thinking, worldview thinking. I've met many scientists who they just think science works. It's neutral. It doesn't imply, it doesn't have any critical philosophical starting points. But that not only misses, I think, a philosophical understanding of science, it fails to appreciate that these principles are not discovered by science. We begin with them. They are starting points. They are presuppositions. I mean, it's true that math seems to work as a way of providing explanation for the natural world, but we don't know that through science. We begin with that idea. Or that the, you know, the universe is uniform. I mean, we don't know how large this universe is. I mean, there are people who've speculated that it may be infinite. How do we know that experiments that we do in, you know, here in our part of the world actually corresponds throughout the universe? Well, we begin with that assumption, and thus far, it's holding up pretty well. So. You know, when I hear kind of leading secular scientists kind of ridicule philosophy, I think that they are showing a point that Mortimer Adler made. He said that most scientists are highly specialized, but not broadly educated. And I think what he means by that, by the way, I don't think he's attacking any scientists. He doesn't intend that as an ad hominem. He's essentially saying that there's a lot of philosophical starting points that come into our practice of science. Well, let's take it a step further here. Let's talk a little bit in the context of Paul Davies' comment. He says that science begins with an essentially theological worldview. Well, let me say this. You know, ask yourself the question, what is Christianity? What is Christianity? I think that I'd need to make four points to answer that question. I think, first of all, Christianity is a set of beliefs, and I think it's primarily a set of beliefs, but it's not exclusively a set of beliefs. I mean, for example, in Judaism and in Islam, I think deeds are more important than creeds. Now, that may be especially true of kind of modern Judaism, could be even kind of secular or liberal Judaism. But I think there's a very fair point there that in Judaism and in Islam, the question is, do you keep kosher? That defines what kind of Jew you are. You know, do you keep the Sabbath? Do you avoid eating meat mixed with milk? In Islam, there's something similar. Do you follow the five pillars, which would involve, praying and saying the creed and taking a pilgrimage to Mecca? Whereas I think what distinguishes Christianity is I think Christianity is primarily a set of beliefs. You know, what do you believe? You can see it in the creeds of Christendom, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed. So I think Christianity is first a set of beliefs, but second, it's a collection of values. And Dave, you're always very good at pointing out that Christianity isn't just a bunch of intellectual ideas. It also involves living a life that reflects Christian values. And so we're made in the image of God. People have dignity and value. God is a holy God. He calls his people to live a life of holiness. So there's the first two, a set of beliefs, a collection of values. Then I would say it's also a way of life. It's a way of living. It is, Christians are called to a life of faith, a life of belief. And I'm going to tie that third one to the fourth one, and that is, I don't think Christianity is a worldview, but I think Christianity encompasses a worldview. And remember what Paul Davies says, to do science, you have to begin with an essentially theological worldview. So let's talk a bit about what a worldview is. And I would say that in simplest terms, a worldview may be defined as how one sees life in the world at large. Again, worldview comes to us from the German Weltanschauung. So this German word Weltanschauung is translated worldview. And there's a couple of ways you can think about a worldview. One way is to think of a worldview as a cluster of beliefs that a person holds about the most important issues of life. So what's your view of God? What's your view of the cosmos, your view of knowledge, values, humanity, and even history? Now, at this point, a worldview sounds a lot like an intellectual scheme, a system of ideas. Now, I think that a worldview is primarily a system of thought, but I don't think it's exclusive. I'll give you an example. C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, their apologetic writings, if you see them that way, and I certainly do, the storytelling that you get from Lewis and Tolkien involves another type of way of thinking about worldview, kind of an imaginative way of thinking. So I had a fellow recently criticize my book. Now I have to remember the title of my own particular book, A World of Difference. He said, well, Ken Sample seems to think a worldview is only an intellectual system. Well, actually, I don't. I think it's primarily that, but it's not exclusively that. So thus far, a worldview is a cluster of beliefs about the most important things. But I think we can think of a worldview as a big picture, a general outlook, a grand perspective on life in the world. And I might add that conceiving of Christianity as encompassing a world and life view, I think it's fair to say that that's largely the product of Protestant evangelicals. I think, for example, if you go back to the early part of the 20th century, 1900, you have Protestant Christians kind of thinking about Christianity as encompassing a worldview. And that has kind of come down to us today, where a lot of the literature that comes out involving Christian apologetics and Christian worldview has the earmarks of conservative evangelical Protestants. Now, that doesn't mean the other branches of Christendom don't think in worldview categories, but I think it does illustrate that conservative Protestants have made a contribution in thinking of the the underlying elements of the Christian worldview. Now, let me bring this right to science. If Davies is right, and that is to do good science, to engage in science, you have to adopt an essentially theological worldview. I have a big question, and that big question is, why is science so late in coming into practice? And this is an important comment. This is an important perspective that I write about in one of my previous books. This is Without a Doubt. And one of the things that is similar between Without a Doubt and Christianity Cross-Examined is that I address questions. Well, in Without a Doubt, chapter 14, the question is, aren't Christianity and science enemies? Well, here I think we can get some very important, a very important perspective. Science is a latecomer on the scene of human history, and modern experimental science emerged in Europe around the middle of the 17th century. So think 1650 in your mind, but that's really late. I mean, that's 1600 years after the person of Christ appears into the world. So my question is, why didn't science come forth sooner? Why didn't it break out all around the globe? And here I think that we're back to Paul Davies. The scientific endeavor can take root only in a fertile soil of a worldview that is conducive to science. And Dave and Joe, one of the points I make in chapter 2 of my latest book, Christianity Cross-Examined, is that you really need three things to have science. You need the right world, you need the right human beings, and you need the right coherence or congruence between the world and the human beings. And not every world is conducive to science. And not every creature is able to track the intelligibility of the world. And not every worldview has mathematics and logic and universal principles that are built into the natural world and are accessible to human beings.
Ken, what do you mean by not every world is conducive to science? We have a world, and it's the only one that I know of. So what do you mean by that?
Well, another way of thinking about a worldview, and now I'm going to use a metaphor or an illustration, you could think of a worldview as like a pair of glasses. So it's true, there's only one world out there, at least you and I and Dave agree with that, and most people in the Western world believe there's only one world out there. Well, I don't know if I can say that anymore. You've got the multiverse. So maybe there's a near infinite number of universes. Of course, there's no observational evidence that any of those universes exist, which I thought was a critical part of science. But let me use that illustration of a pair of glasses. Joe, a Hindu who adopts an Eastern mystical idea, that is, if they look at the world through the lens of philosophical Hinduism, they're not sure that world does exist. The universe may be Maya. It may be an illusion. A Buddhist who has a little bit of a different pair of glasses than Hinduism, although Buddhism came out of Hinduism, in Buddhism, the view is that the universe is beginningless and endless. So they adopt another kind of metaphysical way of looking at the world. And of course, we could kind of look at the postmodern world. I mean, there are philosophers in postmodernism who say you can't trust language. And, you know, so I get a prescription from my doctor each month. I go over to Walgreens and I pick up my prescription and I look at the instructions and it tells me take one of these pills, you know, in the morning and then one at night, but make sure you have some food in your belly because it might cause, you know, you to be a little upset. And I think to myself, do postmodern philosophers, do they trust that language? Do they follow the language of prescription? My point is simply to say this, Joe, I think people have very different lenses as they look at that world. Mm-hmm. And so not everybody has a worldview. So let me say this. Not every culture subscribes to a worldview that's conducive to science. In fact, the foundational philosophical thinking in many historic cultures, I think, clearly inhibits progress toward a scientific outlook. Now, I'm going to introduce you to a Christian thinker here. His name is Stanley Yaki. That last name is J-A-K-I. Yaki was both, first of all, he was a Roman, a very distinguished Roman Catholic thinker. Dave, he was both a physicist and a theologian. So he has background training in both of those fields. I don't know how long he went to college but he had to study theology and science. There's also something I want to tell you about Yaki's interpretation here. Some people think Yaki's interpretation, or the point that I'm going to share with you, some people think it's controversial. And all that means is there are philosophers of science or historians of science who may not all agree with Yaki. Now, I still think he's right. So let me tell you what Yaki is arguing for. Yaki argues that science was still born in other great civilizations outside of Christian Europe because prevailing ideas not only failed to nourish, but also stifled science's development. Now, this is, again, I remember I was giving a lecture at Azusa Pacific University a number of years ago, and after my lecture, one of the panelists who was responding to me, Dr. Jeff Schloss. Some of you may know of Jeff. He is, I think, principally a biologist at Westmont College. He is a leading Christian thinker and scholar in the area of science and faith issues. And I remember him saying, you know, not everybody accepts Yaki's interpretation. So I want to grant that, but I still think that Yaki's right. Now, what does he mean that science was stillborn? Well, think of history. And if you go back into the great civilizations of the world, both West and East, you discover that all of them were very advanced. I mean, there is kind of a chronological snobbery that I think you have to recognize. And that's a term I learned from C.S. Lewis. Chronological snobbery is the idea that whatever ideas that you engage in the present, they're always superior to what people believed in the past. And I reject that idea. I think some of the great civilizations of the past were very insightful. Now, of course, they didn't have computers and they didn't have a lot of things that we have now. And so I'm not shooting down that in the present we have many benefits. But I think if you looked at some of the civilizations of the past, you know, we can talk about India, we can talk about China, we can talk about Egypt, we can talk about Greece and Rome, we could even talk about Baghdad. Because Islam has a very serious interest in science. And right around 800 AD, Baghdad was really a center of learning. Now, what is Yaki's point here? Well, he argues that pagan beliefs, now remember, Yaki is a Christian, he's a Catholic. He shares the same worldview that evangelicals do by and large. According to Yaki, pagan beliefs about reality prevented earlier civilizations from developing a self-sustaining form of scientific inquiry. Now, what in the heck does he mean? Well, you know, think about the idea of a linear approach to ideas. You know, in the Western world, we think kind of in a very linear way. Even when we think about time, you know, we think about past, present, and future. We have this idea that, you know, what we experience time now, and then immediately it moves to the past, but there's something ahead of us. You know, so there's the past, there is the present moment, and then there's the future. Well, in some of the great civilizations of the past, they don't think that way. They have cyclical views of time. Everything repeats. Another idea that is very common in the Eastern mystical areas is the idea of astrology, that you know, the stars are not just you know, critical bodies within the night sky, but the destiny of human beings is written in the stars. You know, are you a Sagittarius? Are you a Gemini? You know, what are you? This again, things are determined by the place of the stars. There are other people that actually deify nature. I mean, some of the pagan religions deified nature. The gods had certain physical qualities, the god of the sea, the god of the heavens. Other deny nature. Hinduism says the natural world may be an illusion, at least in the philosophical variety of Hinduism. And the gods are arbitrary and whimsical. They can change their minds. They can contradict themselves. I mean, even in the advanced religion of Islam, it is said that Allah can reverse himself. Now, that's very foreign to a Jewish and Christian view of Yahweh, where Yahweh doesn't contradict himself and God cannot reverse himself. But it is the point, and again, while this idea is controversial, as a student of the world's religions and as a student of philosophy in general, I think Yaki is right. I think that, you know, if we think about these great civilizations, again, India, China, Egypt, Greece, Rome, and Baghdad, they all made contributions to science, to something like science, contributions to technology or to mathematics. I mean, the word algebra is an Arabic word. And, you know, the Greeks talked about the importance of ideas. So if we think about that idea, I think Yaki is right. I think the reason why science didn't emerge all around the world at a very early time was not every world is conducive to science. Not every worldview supports the basic foundations of science. And what Yaki does in his book, The Savior of Science, now I should tell you, Yaki is not an easy read. Joe, you're a editor. One of the endorsements that I got from J.P. Moreland, and J.P. Moreland's one of my favorite Christian thinkers. He's an eminent Christian philosopher, been at Biola University for a very long time. One of the comments that he said that I really appreciated about my book, Christianity Cross-Examined, he said that it was both substantial and accessible. And I thought, wow, I'm just so happy that he said that, because that was one of my major goals. When I write, I want to write about ideas that are the big ideas, the important ideas. And so I want my work to be substantial, but I want it to be readable. Yaki's works are not very readable. Now again, and I see that as part of my apologetic ministry. I intentionally try to take ideas and make them more accessible so that you don't have to have an advanced degree to kind of make your way through my book. Mm-hmm. Now, Yaki is not easy, so I'm trying to pull some of these pearls out of there and help people think about them. But I think Yaki makes sense. I think the reason why science began once and why it began so late, about 1650 in Europe, where the worldview was Christian, I think the reason that it started there and nowhere else, even though these ancient civilizations, you know, think about the idea of a child. You know, the child has to grow in the womb. And then unfortunately, a lot of pregnancies end in, you know, a stillbirth or something like that. The analogy that Yaki is using is that you have to have a development of culture and society. And the reason that science was so late in coming to the world is that other beliefs inhibited it, that it was uniquely the Christian worldview, the theology of Christianity that allowed science to develop. So let me pause and see if you, Joe or Dave, want to make a comment or what your thinking is.
Yeah, just kind of a question along the lines of what you're talking about in that last point. So you're saying, even though we've had cultures that date back quite a bit, Chinese culture, you know, you have the Greeks and so on, they had some science that developed, but ultimately it phased out, it fiddled out because the worldview wasn't there. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's Yaki's thesis. And I think it carries a lot of sense. I think it makes sense. It's not to say that these ancient civilizations did not make important contributions, but it wasn't able to provide a foundation where science could be fully birthed and then to flourish. Mm-hmm. And so Yaki is supporting the idea that Paul Davies set forth, and that is you essentially have to have a theological worldview to do science. You have to be thinking regularity, patterns. You have to be thinking, okay, this makes sense, and human beings can track the intelligibility. I remember Paul Davies saying in an interview I heard him give, he said the thing that really, really puzzles him is not that the world is ordered, but he said the thing that really puzzles him is that human beings have the faculties to actually track the intelligibility of the universe. So it's not just that we have a universe that is conducive to science or a view of the world that makes science possible, but you also have human beings that have the qualities and characteristics to track it. I mean, we don't have to have humans with large brains that have intellectual abilities, that we don't have to have, you know, very capable cognitive faculties and sensory organs that are careful and precise. I think that's a very powerful thing. And so, again, in chapter 2 of my new book, Christianity Cross-Examined, I say you need three things. You need the right world, and then you need the right human beings, because human beings do science. The world doesn't do science. It's humans in the world that do science. But then you need some kind of intellectual grounding between that world and the minds of human beings. Christianity does a really good job of providing that theological framework.
I have a question. Why, if Christianity provides this philosophical worldview background that is, you know, supportive of science, why did it take 1650 years of Christianity before science began to bring forth fruit?
It's a very good question. And I appreciate that question. My answer to that question, Dave, is that Christianity needed to come fully bloomed. And what I mean by that is Christian civilization took a while in order to kind of naturally develop. I don't think you can have science apart from the great medieval universities, Oxford, Cambridge, the University of Paris, these great universities. Now again, when I was going to school, I was always told that the Middle Ages, that was the Dark Ages. And then I began reading and I discovered that there was a lot of intellectual activity in the Middle Ages. I think the reason why it took a century and a half was that Christianity needed to come in full bloom. It needed to express its worldview and to develop schools where you could combine both philosophy and science together. And that took a long time. Now, again, I don't want to exclude these other civilizations. I mean, I think Christian Europe, you know, so if you think of Christianity coming in the first century, by the fifth century, Christianity had kind of converted paganism into Christianity, but there was also the problem of, and the reason we get the term Dark Ages was the learning of the Greco-Roman culture was eclipsed. So Christians had to develop their schools. They had to uncover many of the great truths that had been hidden by the transformation of culture. And so it took a while to do this. And in fact, Dave, I would say this. I think the development of the natural sciences is one of the greatest accomplishments, intellectual accomplishments in the history of humanity. So it took a lot of work.
Ken, would an example of what you're talking about be the rise of genetics? Because if I remember correctly, Gregor Mendel, is that the person who developed genetics or early insights into genetics? He did all of this in the context of a monastery, if I'm not mistaken. Am I correct in that? And you're saying we needed universities and that kind of thing to disseminate these ideas? Am I tracking with you okay there or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not only are the founding fathers of science almost to a person Christian, although I don't want to exclude Judaism, you know, I recognize that, you know, Christians have accepted the Hebrew Bible and many of the great truths about creation and about human nature come out of the Hebrew scriptures, and they are affirmed in the New Testament. But that's absolutely right. I think to get a thoroughgoing science, it took some really bright minds and investment and reflection. And I think the reason it took a long time is, again, Christianity had to develop as a faith that really did encompass a worldview. And we had to develop schools of learning and reflection. And science is a very sophisticated enterprise, and it doesn't come easily. And so people like Mendel and Pascal and, Faraday, I mean, these are these extraordinary names. And again, I also want to give credit to Judaism. I mean, you know, there are only about 16 million Jews in the world. How many of the great intellectuals are Jewish? I mean, they have this incredible intellectual tradition. And I think Christianity embraced that and benefited from that. And so, Dave, it took some time. But the Dark Ages were a lot brighter than a lot of people appreciate.
Mm-hmm. When was the Alexandria Library destroyed?
Well, you know, Alexandria, of course, goes all the way back to Egypt. And Alexandria is one of the great intellectual centers even before Christianity, but Christians benefited from it. I'm not sure I can give you a date about the destruction of it, but, you know, you have these ancient civilizations and learning, but there's also separations in East and West. So a little bit later, I want to talk about some of the things that kind of helped science come together, but I can't give you a date on that. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, let's look at a couple of issues here. One of the issues that I want to talk about is outspoken skeptical people say that science and Christianity are enemies. I think that's false. I think that more often they've been allies. More often they've had a very intimate relationship. Now, have there been controversies? Well, of course. The controversy of Galileo is well known. There's the controversy of Darwin. How does evolution fit within a context of creation? But there's also the question of the Dark Ages and the question of the Enlightenment. Some people would propose, for example, that science began with the Enlightenment, and enlightened thinkers moved away from religion and God as an authority and began to use human reason. And the Enlightenment was the period which gave rise to science. But I think that that's incorrect for two reasons. One, the earliest Enlightenment thinkers were almost exclusively religious. And secondly, the scientific enterprise comes a full century before the Enlightenment comes in full bloom in the 1700s. So, you know, sometimes we're given stories about science. And you want to be careful about those stories. There are people today who are outspoken atheists. They want to give us the perspective that science and Christianity are enemies. And I'm going to talk about that here in just a moment. Now, some of you listening will no doubt, as you think about religion and science or Christianity and science, you'll be familiar with the name Ian Barber. Ian Barber wrote a book, Religion and Science, where he proposed four ways of relating science and religion. Those four ways are I can enumerate them as: one, conflict; two, independence; three, dialogue; four, integration. Well, this book has had a very strong view on how we think about the history of science. Of course, there are people today who would suggest that of the four, the one that reflects the truth about religion and science would be conflict. They're at war with one another, right? Now, number two, independence would mean they're totally separate categories. Some people would talk about non-overlapping magisteria. Thirdly, that somehow they're in dialogue with one another. But number four, they're integrative. Now, that brings you to reasons to believe. Reasons to believe would look at Barber's four descriptions of religion and science and say, you know, you have these two books. You have the book of nature, you have the book of scripture. God is the author of both books. If they're properly interpreted, because they come from the same mind, they're not going to contradict. Now, of course, as we think more about science, I think some would say, well, I'm not sure about integration. I mean, I think it's possible that Reasons to Believe's most controversial perspective is not the age of the universe. It may be our concordism. That is our view that there is a concord, there is a unity, a compatibility between scripture and the metaphorical book of nature. I mean, you know, you look at somebody like John Walton, he's critical of RTB's concordism. I think probably the very distinguished scientist and theologian Alistair McGrath would probably be a bit critical. I think McGrath would probably reflect more of a dialogue. They're compatible with each other. But RTB takes a very strong position of integration. Now, let me look at a little bit of this narrative about what is the proper way of thinking about these two areas. Well, science historian Ronald Numbers, he is a historian of science. Interesting, very interesting person, by the way. I have a background in studying new religious movements in what we called in those days cults. And when I worked with Walter Martin, who was the original Bible Answer Man and the founder of the Christian Research Institute, Walter had me study Catholicism and Adventism. And of course, that kind of put me in a little bit of a different category because Walter didn't view Catholicism and Adventism as being cults. He thought that they were Christian groups, unlike the Latter-day Saints, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, Christian Science, etc. But I came to know Ronald Numbers, not for his historical analysis of science, but that Ron Numbers was an Adventist. And he was one of the early scholars who discovered that the prophetic figure in Adventism, Ellen G. White, had plagiarized some of her writings. And that led to Numbers questioning his Adventist belief and even giving up his Christian belief. So when I began reading Numbers, I was like, well, Ron Numbers is a former Adventist. That was a very difficult time. I've tried to talk with him a little bit about that, and that was a difficult thing for him. But I think what it illustrates here is the importance of those books, the book of Scripture and the book of nature, and how we handle, you know, that material. Well, I like Ron Numbers' historical analysis in science. He essentially says that this narrative, this warfare narrative, the conflict model, if you will, between science and religion, that it's false. Now, here's a couple books that reflect that conflict. One is by John William Draper. It's entitled History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. Here's another book that reflects that. It's by Andrew W. White, A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology. And of course, in my new book, I quote Christopher Hitchens, and I quote Dan Dennett, and a number of the new atheists who try to propose. Jerry Coyne would be another person. Peter Atkins would be another person. Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, you know, the four horsemen of the new atheism. They try to convey the idea that, you know, science poisons everything, to quote Hitchens.
Religion.
I'm sorry, religion poisons everything. And Jerry Coyne would say science gives you truth, but, you know, theology gives you speculation. Coyne even says that theologians are jealous of science. Now, I think the reality is something very different. And again, this brings us back to today, the world in which we live in, where, you know, some ideas are not factually correct. You have propaganda. Now don't get me wrong. There have been real times of conflict between science and religion, between science and Christianity. I think the Galileo situation was unfortunate, but I think it's actually rare. I think for the most part, there has been quite a historical connection. And in fact, let me give you two contemporary examples of this warfare conflict. Here's a book Faith versus Fact, Why Science and Religion Are Incompatible by Jerry Coyne. And then A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing by Lawrence Krauss. Well, not only has Ron Numbers, I think, proven that the warfare or the conflict narrative is false, but there is a fairly new book, came out a few years ago, entitled, let me give you the title, The Genesis of Science, and here's the subtitle, How the Christian Middle Ages Launched the Scientific Revolution. The author is a historian, James Hannum. And here's what he says in that book. He says, quote, it's popularly imagined that the history of science and religion is one of violent conflict, but the facts don't bear this out, close quote. Another place he says this, the conflict between science and creationism is real enough, but it is the exception, not the rule. For most of history, science and religion have rubbed along just fine. Now, let me talk more about this idea of Christian history and the development of Christian thinking in history. Alistair McGrath, who is a remarkable Christian thinker, he has 3 PhDs at Oxford University. It just boggles my mind.
Wow. Can't make up his mind.
He has a PhD in science. It's something like, I can never remember the exact area. But he has a PhD in science. He has another PhD in intellectual history. And then he has a doctoral degree in theology. McGrath says that in the Middle Ages, Christians made contributions to the ultimate development of science. He says, for example, there was the translation of important Greek and Arabic science-related texts into Latin. So some of the things that these ancient civilizations had developed took time for them to move from the Greek language in the East to the Latin language in the West. So again, I want to be generous and give credit to some of these ancient civilizations. They made real contributions. I mean, is there anybody alive today who is a better philosopher than Aristotle or Plato? I mean, there's some really good philosophers today, but I think the best philosophers today would say they're indebted to some of these ancient thinkers. McGrath says too, that there was the establishment of the great universities of Western Europe. These were schools of learning. Dave, you and I, what was it, 2019? Maybe it was 2018. We visited Oxford University and we were walking around. I remember shaking my head and saying, this university is almost 1,000 years old.
Mm.
It goes back to the Middle Ages. Well, I'm not sure there's a greater university than Oxford in existence today. It's certainly one of them. Its origins are from the Middle Ages, but I thought that was the Dark Ages. Well, there was a lot of light too. Mm-hmm. McGrath mentions a third point, Christian theologians and philosophers affirming the value of studying nature. Now again, unlike Hinduism, unlike Gnosticism, which was a heresy that said, you know, the world, the material world is evil and spiritual is good. You know, Christians said, no, there's a real world out there and it's a valuable place. So this kind of gives us a background, and let me kind of conclude this program, Joe, by saying this, that modern experimental science was born and nurtured and ultimately flourished within the Christian European civilization. Why? Because the Christian vision of reality possesses all of the necessary presuppositions to undergird the scientific enterprise. Now, I want to talk more about that in our next program, But just to kind of summarize here a little bit, you know, science only works in a world that is conducive to science. And it only works if the presuppositions actually fit and match. And it only works if human beings have these remarkable intellectual abilities. I mean, think of it. I think the reason why Paul Davies says that the intelligibility of the world kind of bothers him somewhat. I mean, what are the chances? Let's suppose there's no God, no mind behind the universe, no divine direction in the created order. So I don't know where the world came from if there's no God. Maybe it's a brute reality. Maybe it's just there, although it doesn't give signs of being a brute reality, gives signs of having an origin, a beginning. But again, we'll assume an atheist perspective. What are the chances that human beings would have developed the cognitive faculties and sensory organs well enough to be able to do science? You know, some skeptical scientists have said, you know, humans are more endowed than, you know, being able to throw rocks and pick bananas. They are incredibly endowed. And what are the chances they would have those intellectual abilities? And what are the chances that there's this intellectual tool chest called science, called math and logic? Now, if God exists, then I think you have the trifecta makes sense. You have the right world, you have the right humans, you have the right congruence. Why? Because all of that flows out of the rational mind of God. Joe, again, I write about this in the first two chapters of my latest book, Christianity Cross-Examined, but I also write about it in Without a Doubt and in Seven Truths That Changed the World.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much, Ken. I appreciate all the valuable insights that you offer in this chapter, as we've heard on this podcast. I'm sure Dave would echo that. We've read the book, so we're excited about it anyway. We hope people listening who have not picked up the book will do so soon, Christianity Cross-Examined. Let us know your comments and questions. You can reach Ken via his Twitter handle, @RTB_KSamples. In fact, here's a message that came to us recently, Ken, from a listener. I'm getting into Ken's new book. This is undoubtedly his best and perhaps the best work of tying all of RTB's messages into a seamless flow of reasoning. Great job.
Wow, I like that.
We appreciate that, yeah. I didn't get the person's name, but thank you so much for that compliment, and kudos to you, Ken, for doing a great job. We hope obviously we're doing this because we want people to benefit and use these materials for their own enrichment. I'm enriched, you know, just by listening again what I've read in your book, so that I can go out and share it with others, and I'm sure others are doing the same. So keep that up. All right, that's going to wrap it up for this podcast. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.